final class this afternoon is titled A Lesson in Economics for the Morning. Well, we appear to have survived the awkward third talk and heading towards the home straight now. And number four, I'm very impressed at you all sitting through four talks. I was debating with myself whether I had the harder job giving four talks or you listening to them. It's probably pretty even, I would think. Anyway, this is the last one for today, a lesson in economics. I feel rather out of my depth talking about this in the presence of at least one ex-member of the IMF and other people who have more expertise in economics than I have. Nevertheless, it's there in Ecclesiastes, so I cannot but talk about it. Just think about this. We simply don't have time to look at all this, but just think about these terms and how so much of the language that the preacher uses comes from the realms of economics and finance. This is something you might just like to follow through in your own time. Just read through the book and just note down every reference that would relate to that theme. It's quite a staggering exercise to do it. He talks about money. He talks about wages. The concept of inheritance, heritage. He talks about the rich and riches. He talks about success and accomplishments. He talks about accounts. He talks about consuming and consumption. He talks about deficit, about what is lacking. He talks about abundance and wealth. He talks about venture and business. He talks about a portion, an allotment. He talks about profit. And when you add all that lot together, you get an awful lot of references that relate to this theme. And so that was an important framework or grid that the preacher used, according to which things can be evaluated. And the most significant of all those terms, I think, is the term profit. And we'll come on to that shortly. I'd like to start, though, at the end of that passage, at the end of chapter 7. That's really quite an interesting passage, and this seems like a sensible time to talk about it. Verse 23, and we'll find a link here with some of the things that we've been saying already. All this have I proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me, that which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? So we were talking about that, weren't we, at the end of the last talk, about the limits to the extent to which we can understand and really know all we might like to know or wish to know about this life and what the things in it mean. So he's been the one who's been trying to seek and find it out, and he's recognizing that it is far from him. It's far from him to be as wise as he truly wishes to be. And if it is Solomon, then he's the wisest man there was. And he's saying, but where he wants to get to with wisdom is far from him. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? I applied my heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom. So this isn't just a thing that you can say, right, good, got it, that's wisdom, got it under my belt. He deliberately uses three terms there to describe the process: to know, to search, to seek out wisdom, and the reason of things, the AV supplies, and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. So look at all those words of seeking. Finding, knowing, searching, seeking, knowing. And I find, verse 26, more bitter than death, the woman. Now, isn't that odd? Because you thought that he was seeking out knowledge and wisdom and the reason of things, and suddenly he has found something. And what has he found? It's like you're trying to catch a fish and you find something else. I won't pick anything now because that would be an unfortunate analogy. But you see, he's got this woman now, he's found, instead of the wisdom that he was seeking or hoping to find. He finds more bitter than death, and it's no coincidence that the word find is the very word that he's just been using in the previous verses, you say, deliberate at that point. I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. She sounds a bit frightening, doesn't she? Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher. Here's the editor popping up again. You remember we looked at that verse before, didn't we? Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account. Here's our economics term, or our accounting term, as it happens. So, meticulously now, going through one by one, item by item of the ledger lines, counting to find out the account. What is the conclusion? What is the balance at the end of it all? Is it the wisdom, the knowledge that he hopes to have found? No, it's not that. He couldn't find that, verse 28, which yet my soul seeketh after, but I find not. He can't do the equation, he can't come to the answer at the bottom of the page, he can't find out that knowledge and wisdom that he's seeking for. He finds instead a man, one man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. Lo, this only have I found. You see, the whole thing is a play on finding and not finding, isn't it? The whole passage revolves around that concept. What is the passage trying to say? Well, that's a more difficult question. But at least we've identified what it revolves around. It revolves around finding. Lo, this only have I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. So what do we do with that? What about this woman and this man? Well, that's difficult, isn't it? But it's interesting that he shouldn't find one woman amongst a thousand. And how many wives and concubines did Solomon have? Well, precisely that number. And not one of them was the kind of spiritual wife that he ought to have chosen. And the thought comes back, doesn't it? Well, no, you haven't found them, Solomon, because you weren't looking in the right place. You were going marrying the daughter of Pharaoh in Egypt. So, seems to me beyond coincidence that he should use that phrase when that is exactly the number of his women. And he's saying, you know, I had a good go at finding the right one, and I tried 1,000, and there wasn't one that was spiritually right. And he's saying, just occasionally, really, really occasionally, I find a man. I found one man in 1,000, which isn't a high success rate, is it? Who is on the same wavelength as I am, with whom I can have a spiritual fellowship with, let's say. And that is a really precious thing, isn't it? Of course, we do indeed, in a very real sense, share spiritual fellowship with one another. But to find someone who is on a similar spiritual wavelength to you and sort of understands where you're coming from and is coming from a similar sort of place, and whom you can really relate to when you talk about spiritual matters, that is a very precious thing to find, isn't it? And it's something that we should be very grateful for if we find it, and we should treasure and build upon such a relationship. So he says, very occasionally I've found someone that I could share that with, but I've never found a woman amongst all my wives that were like that. So whose fault is that? Well, that's not stated, but in a way, the other scriptures tell us whose fault that was. Or is there something else going on here as well? Could it be that the woman, bitter than death, whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. Is not that the very woman, the very harlot woman, pictured in Proverbs 1 to 9? And of course it is. That's exactly how she's described. Or pretty exactly. That's not a contradiction in terms. You can recognise that woman as the evil woman in Proverbs 9. And if you go into, Proverbs 1 to 9. And if you go into Proverbs 1 to 9, you find in fact there are two women. And there is that evil woman, and there is also the woman, the wise woman, Lady Wisdom, as some people call her. There is the wise woman who speaks in chapter 1 and chapter 3 and chapter 8. And is Solomon saying, I've done all this looking and seeking and I could only ever find the wrong woman. I could only ever find sin. And I was looking for the woman, the wise woman. I was looking for wisdom. And indeed, he told us earlier on, at the opening of this passage, that he was searching for wisdom and knowledge and he couldn't find it. He's only been able to net the wrong woman, as it were. So I think probably there might be both of those things going on in that passage. Now, of course, the reason why we came to the passage was because it had this idea of Solomon looking up and counting by line to find the account. And what did he find? Well, he didn't find the right woman, he found the wrong woman, and we know how easy it is to find sin in comparison to how easy it is, or how difficult it is to find wisdom, even though God has given it to us right in front of us. And yet he finds something else as well in verse 20, in verse 19, verse 29. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. It's like that's his conclusion. And I think there's some irony in that as well, that was the all that work and effort, and that was the best he could come up with. That God has made man upright, that in a way there's all this potential in man, and yet he seeks out many inventions. And though Solomon could have pursued that wise woman, yet he ends up with 1,000 other ones who weren't wise and spiritual. Makes you think, doesn't it? And makes you think what a blessing a wise and spiritual wife is. Let's get on now with, let's just have a time check. Let's get on now with our consideration of this concept of profit then. Let's move on in our economics investigation. And we'll come to that by way of the idea of labour. And of course, it's central to economics, isn't it? That you know, for a certain amount of labour and then the productivity of that labour and what's the purpose of that labour is that at the end, you know, you have some revenue coming out of the other end and that you make a profit from your labour that you've taken. And that's indeed the very first question that the book opened with, isn't it? Inside the frame, vanity of vanity, saith the preacher, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all the labour which he taketh under the sun? What profit does he have from all the labour, all his work? And some of you have retired, some of you still working. And we do all that work, don't we? And we give that huge portion of our lives to work. And what's the profit of it? And it doesn't take long after we've left. We may have been ever so important in our companies, or we may have been not important at all, but whichever way it is, we'll soon be forgotten once we're gone. And what profit is there? And of course, we needed those jobs to, in the sweat of our face, so that we could eat bread, and we've eaten a lot of bread over the course of our lives. And what profit has there been from that? Well, where's that gone? You know, we can't have that back, can we? That bread that we've eaten. And consumption. So much of our lives are dominated by consumption of things. And that's one of the measures of the economy, isn't it? The amount of consumption that goes on. And what profit is there from all that consumption? Well, that comes to be a very personal question. What profit have we had from our work? Well, yes, there are certain financial implications that have come from it, and then, you know, ultimately we'll leave that all behind, and then there'll be the vanity of that the preacher talks about. But what profit has it been to us in a spiritual sense? Well, that depends on us. It depends on what we've made of it. It depends of depends on the extent to which we've been open to learn the lessons that our labour might have taught us if we've been listening to God talking to us in our lives in that way, through the things that have happened to us in our lives. So, is it good to work? Well, it's kind of a theoretical question because we've not got much option about it, but that was what God decreed for us, that we should work. And Paul said, if a man that will not work, neither should he eat. So, but is it good to work? Well, yes, the preacher tells us that it is good to work, and that, you know, that it is good for us in that sense to work. It's good for you, like eating your vegetables when you're a child. And yet you'll never be full from it. It'll be a toil, and it won't make you full no matter how much you earn. You won't be full. You won't be satisfied. That's how it's likely to be anyway. And if you are in all things, in whatsoever state you are, content, then you'll only be like that because you've learnt to be so, not because it comes naturally to human beings to be that way. So let's have a look at a passage about labour in chapter 4 and verse 4. So we need to think about the limits of labour then, and we need to think, well, how much of our energies do we devote to our labour? And while it's true that we should do all things as unto the Lord, the preacher is pointing out to us that we're pretty foolish, really, if we allow ourselves to be consumed by our work. Because there is no profit from our labour, in that sense. So if we've given all our energies to that, if we've given the best part of ourselves to that, rather than to God, then we shall have done things the wrong way around. So we put God in place first, and then the other elements of life fit round that, and then our lives will not be vain. They'll be built in the right way. Let's have a look at chapter 4, verse 4. Again, I considered all travail, that and every right work, that for this a man is envied of his neighbour. And there's another of these great ironies, isn't it? You work so hard, and then what happens? Other people are jealous of you, and they resent you for it. Or maybe you want that. Maybe you want them to be envious of you because you've achieved so much and you live in such a big house. But that's a vanity too. Whichever way you cut it. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. The fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. Let's just think about how this passage is constructed here then. So he's saying, consider travail and every right work, and that seems to be a good thing, to do right work, but yet people will envy you for it. However, on the other hand, and the whole passage is a series of on the other hand, the fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. So even though people might envy you for working hard, nevertheless, that is what you want to do. You do want to do your work, because if you're a fool and you fold your hands together and you don't do anything, you'll end up having to eat yourself, a kind of cannibalism, which won't be very pleasant. And yet, on the other hand, verse 6, better is a handful with quietness than both hands full with travail and vexation of spirit. So keep it in perspective now. Don't work so hard that you've got all this stuff, because that's only going to create vanity and vexation of spirit. So, you know, there's all these yeah but, yes but, yes but, and somehow through all those observations, which are true in a sense and up to a certain point, you have to make a course. You have to chart a course and try to live life with respect to work in a spiritual way. Not easy. That's a challenging thing. It could, of course, be the case that he's being even more cynical than what I've described when it says, the fool foldeth his hands and eateth his own flesh. Could he be saying, you know, flesh, like flesh, meat, food? Could he be saying, but look at the fool. The fool doesn't do anything. He just sits back, and yet he's still got his own flesh to eat. He's still got his food to eat. Maybe he's not talking about cannibalism. Maybe he's saying, well, the fool gets by, even though he doesn't work so hard. So there's maybe an ambiguity in what that passage means. And I suspect more and more as I read the book that some of those ambiguities are there deliberately. So, you know, you think that he's saying one thing and that he might actually be saying, yeah, but on the other hand, because that's exactly what his style is. Well, let's get on at last to our term prophet, and we saw it in chapter 1 and verse 3. That was the opening reference to it. Let me just, I think this is such a key term to the book. I'd like to just give you my eyes aren't very good. In fact, when I arrived in the US and went to an optician, I was told that I was legally blind in one eye and have no peripheral vision, which is something that the UK opticians over 33 years had failed to observe. Apparently it took an American one to spot it. So I can't actually see whether anyone's taking any notes or not, but I'd like to just read you this list of verses, and anyway, it's on the tape. Because it's the term which literally means something that goes beyond, something which goes further. And you can see how that relates to the notion of prophet. It's used a lot of times. It's not always translated prophet. So these are the verses where it's used. 1 verse 3, 2 verse 11, 13 and 15, 3 verse 9, 6 verse 8 and 11, 7 verse 11, 12 and 16, 10 verse 10 and 11, 12 verse 9 and 12. So that's quite a lot of references then, isn't it, to this concept of prophet, to something which goes beyond. And think of that in terms of, you know, what goes beyond this life maybe, or what goes beyond the effort that was involved to create it. Something which lasts and endures. What profit has a man from all his labour? Well, let's have a look at another passage in chapter 7. And I'm hoping that by the end of tomorrow, we'll have looked at pretty close to all the main passages in Ecclesiastes. Well, certainly we'll have looked at the main themes. There'll be other passages that we've not looked at, but which are somewhat akin to the message in the passages that we do take. Chapter 7 and verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. And you see the margin says, wisdom is as good as an inheritance. So this is an analogy being made between wisdom and an inheritance. So, you know, it's nice to have an inheritance. It's nice to know that you've got something coming to you. And wisdom is like that, then. He doesn't specify in what sense, but, you know, this is a passage where it's a sort of, you know, let's hear it for wisdom. There's something good to be said about wisdom here. Wisdom is good as an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. So it is worthwhile being wise. Yes, there are a lot of yes buts, but nevertheless, broadly it's true that it's a good thing to be wise. Whether we take that as, you know, being smart about how we manage our affairs, you know, thinking about what we're doing, using our common sense, or whether we take it in a rather bigger sense than that. It's good to be wise. For wisdom is a defence, and money is a defence. Well, you can see how that is true too. You know, it's useful to be sat. It feels better to be sat on a pot of cash in case something bad happens than it does to not be. A simple point that he's making. Wisdom is a defence and money is a defence, but the excellency of wisdom, and here he uses the term, that is the term profit again, the way in which wisdom goes further than money as a defence, the excellency of wisdom, the superiority, the profit of wisdom over money is that it gives life to those who have it. Wisdom has a chance of saving your life. And you can see that that would actually be true on the everyday level, as it would potentially, as it would on the spiritual level. There's possibly an ambiguity there as well, because the term which is the term which is used for defence there can also mean shadow. And you see how, like a big rock that was a defence might be a shadow, and the shadow of the wings being like a defence. But so there's a sort of ironic double entendre there about wisdom being a shadow, something that you can't really get your hands on, and money being like that too, being a fleeting, ephemeral type thing, even though it seems so physical and so real, yet in fact it's a fleeting vanity. But the excellency of wisdom, what's better about wisdom, is that it has the power to give life. So there's one of the examples of the term prophet being used in a slightly different way. And I don't want that verse right now. excuse me, let's go to chapter 5. Chapter 5 and verse 9. So we want to have a few minutes in chapter 5 and a few minutes in chapter 2, and then we'll conclude with a New Testament passage. That's where we're going. So Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 9. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. The king himself is served by the field. Fair enough. So there's a great leveller then. We all have to eat food, and where does that food come from? It comes from the earth, which God has blessed. Moreover, the profit of the earth is for all. He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This also is vanity. You know, if we didn't know ourselves, we would think that we would be, wouldn't we? We would think that if only we had so much silver, then we would be satisfied, and then we'd say, fine, that's wonderful, I've got to where I wanted to go, and now I'm content. And yet we know ourselves too well, that however much we have, there is this trigger within us to desire more, unless we really control our thinking with discipline. When goods increase, then are they increased that eat them. That's for a long time. I love that verse. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? So an ironic comment on his own experience, I suppose. He'd amassed so much, and everyone came to see and came to eat at their table, but you know, were they really his friends? Or were they just there to have a good meal? And what could Solomon do? He could watch them having a nice meal, and there is some satisfaction in that, I'm sure. And yet, it wasn't all that it was cracked up to be, let's say. It wasn't all that he'd hoped it might be. The sleep of a labouring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. So this contrast between the seeking after many things, and then when you get there, when you have many things, and whoever thinks that they do, when you get there, then you find that there are all these parasites who want a bit of it too, and you find that you've got all these concerns that you didn't have before, and life has become so much more complicated than it was when you didn't have so much. Nice juxtaposition, isn't it, of just being satisfied with the things of the field and having the sweet sleep of a labouring man and being cumbered about with all these riches. And let's have a look too at verse 15. Well, I mean, in verse 13 and 14 he makes the point that, and as well, even if you have all that stuff, you never know if your life's going to be required of you at a moment's notice, and then you don't know what's going to happen. These riches perish by an evil travail, and he begetteth a son, and there is nothing in his hand. Your riches go like that, and you have nothing to leave to your son. And that was all you were building for all your life, and then suddenly it's all brought to nothing by an evil travail. And you think of Jesus' parable of the barns and the rich man who knocked them down to make bigger ones. Thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee. And what is going to happen, whether you've had a lot or a little? Verse 15, as he came forth of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and shall take nothing of his labour, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a sore evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit hath he that hath laboured for the wind? So the money then, all those possessions that he had, has become wind as he's died. His vain death. And his possessions have become a vanity too. They disappeared from him. He's laboured for the wind, and it's all come to nothing. So again, the question comes home. What is it that we're striving for? And what better passage is there to drive that home than chapter 2? Let's go to chapter 2 now. And this is now widened out from materialism specifically to other endeavours in which humans love to engage. And so this is this great experiment that the preacher did to try everything out and to see if there was any profit in it. So we talked about measuring profits in the way that human beings usually measure it, with dollar signs and pound signs, and we've seen the limits to that, and we've seen the preacher tell us, well, don't put all your hopes in that, because that's not going to get you where you want to go. What other things are there in life in which I could strive after, and what would the profit of those things be? Well, it's a fun experiment, isn't it? And I suspect that, in a sense, it's an experiment that we all engage in to some degree, and hopefully we don't take it as far as Solomon did. We don't have the opportunity to take it as far as Solomon did. Hopefully when we see his experience, we can recognize the rightness of it, and that can halt us in our path. You know, you can ask the question, is this a good experiment? Is this a good thing to do? Well, it's too late to ask that question for Solomon, because he's done it, and he spent his life doing what he did. And God will be the judge of what he did. What should I do with my life, and what should you do with yours, given the lessons that Solomon is about, or the preacher is about to tell us from what he did? Well, I don't need to replicate his experiments, and I don't need to fool myself in the way that I so easily do, that if only I had this, or if only I did this, then life would be so much better. And then I would have a profit. I would have something to hang on to, something which persists that I don't have. Chapter 2, verse 1, I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. So, hedonism, then. I will prove thee with mirth. So I don't know, but I don't know what that meant. What did it, you know, it's like that he brings in the best court jesters in the world and they all troop through. He goes to the circus, and stand up comedians stand up and try to amuse him. Imagine it how you will. And at first it's pretty funny. And he's laughing quite wholeheartedly. And gradually the laughter becomes hollow, and it's not actually so funny, is it? In fact, it's not funny at all. And is that what it's all about, then? Is that what life's about? Is it the case that if I immerse myself in that, then I'll have so much better a life? Nope, that's a vanity. I said of laughter, it is bad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in my heart to give myself to wine. Maybe if I had a huge cellar, and if I had some wines from, I don't know what vintage, I don't know very much about wine at all, but maybe then my life would be really good. And, you know, this is almost becoming a parody of itself, isn't it? Because I know that, of course, that wouldn't make a difference. I might enjoy the wine at the time, but what is man the better by that? Or golf, and however many rounds of that, and whichever courses I might play on, is that where there is profit? Is that what will do it for me? What else does he try? I will I thought in my heart to give myself to wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under heaven all the days of their life. So I don't know quite what that means, what the acquainting himself with folly means, whether it means behaving in a way that people would have considered irresponsible. You know, maybe it means what in our day might be the equivalent of going out wild partying and binging. I don't know what it would be. Maybe that's the way to have a really good life. Nope, that's vanity too. I made me great works. I builded many houses. I planted me vineyards, verse 4. I made me gardens and orchards. I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidservants and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were before me in Jerusalem. And can you start to recognize yourself a little bit in this? And can you feel that this is actually a bit awkward. It makes me a bit uncomfortable reading this, really. Because I can see some of my own endeavours, and I can see how I project onto things in this really stupid way. I'll take the materialism example again, because it's something that I struggle with, and I guess many people struggle with. You know, if only I had that thing and I get into something new and think, if only I had that one, then my life would be really good. You know, what kind of a fool am I, kidding myself in that way? And it's like I can't think about anything else until that moment. And now society's actually got this expression to describe that, PPD, post-purchase depression, where I actually get that thing and I find out my life's just the same as it was before. And I'm not any better. And I'll survive on it, and maybe I'll feel guilty, actually. Maybe I'll actually have the depression that it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And, you know, let's continue with golf, that I'm still actually a rubbish golfer, even with that set of clubs. It's not helped me at all. It's actually made me feel worse sometimes. Interesting that the society is actually now recognizing that. I mean, people are writing about this stuff, you know, about the psychology of this, and recognizing the emptiness of it all. So there we are, gardening there, houses, building houses. Possessions, great and small. Verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men and musical instruments and of all sorts. So he turned himself to whatever it might be that he could give himself to. But yet he finds, when he really buries into it, that the same gnawing emptiness is there in his life. And it's that emptiness that can only be filled with a faith in God. It can't be filled by any material thing or any pursuit. No matter how highbrow, how cultured, how civilized, how sophisticated, how educational, they will not work to satisfy a man. The eye is not filled with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. Verse 9. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also, why my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my portion of all my labor. So he's, you know, there's a kind of honesty here. He says, well, it was good fun. I withheld not my heart from any joy, and my heart rejoiced in all my labor. He was really into what he was doing, as we are when we do these things. And this was my portion of all my labor. And so he had his reward, that was his portion. Verily they have their reward, Jesus said. And if that's what you want, then fine. You spend your life like that, I suppose, is the point. Then, verse 11, this is a fantastic verse. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on all the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. So there's the context then to think about all our endeavors and all our activities. That's the great thing that we can use to balance out all these things, isn't it? And to get our lives in perspective with God at the center. Let's finish in 2 Corinthians 4. I'll say that passage in Ecclesiastes 2, it's one of my favourite passages, because he builds up to through all those things that we can relate to and think, yeah, that'd be really good to be doing that. And he first of all, he says, so I rejoice in all my labour, and you think that he's saying, yeah, it's good. And then he finds, and then he just chops the tree down that he's just grown. In verse 11, and said, then I looked at it all. I stood back and I looked at what I was doing, and it was all vanity and vexation of spirit. And I saw myself as I really was, and I saw all my futile labor and all my desires, and how I centered my desires on all those things, and they were the wrong things. And now in 2 Corinthians 4, we've got the right things. Verse 16. For which cause, with the hope of the gospel in our hearts now, and with life not lived as an end in itself under the sun, with the hope of the gospel in our hearts, we faint not. But though our outward man perish, as we saw described in Ecclesiastes 12, though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, and those vanities which are offset by other good things in life that we'll talk about tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be a whole lot more positive, I hope, than today has been. Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, that travail and labour that God has put upon the sons of men to be exercised therewith, that light affliction endures but for a moment and works in us a far more exceeding and eternal, what? Weight of glory. It works in us a weight of glory. And what is weight but the very opposite of the term vanity? That's exactly what it is, isn't it? That affliction and those trials and the vanities of our lives as human beings, the human condition, if we live those with our knowledge of God, fearing him and keeping his commandments, that will work in us, if we approach life in the right way, they will work in us something which has a weight, something which has substance, which is tangible, which survives, which is profitable. And it's a weight of glory. And I expect you know that's a play on words, because the Hebrew word for glory literally means weight, something which is substantial, something which endures. While we look not at the things which are seen, the things of this world, like golf clubs and houses and vineyards and bottles of wine, while we look not at those things, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal.